Well, welcome everyone. I wanted to thank the congregation of Sauk County for being welcoming to us and the Prairie folks for changing their routine a little bit. This is basically because I originally double booked myself, so it was not originally intentional, but I think it's a great opportunity. Over the years, our two congregations have gotten together on various occasions, and this is another chance to do that. I'm Robin Proud, and I have the honor to be one of the rotating speakers at Sauk County. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. But I do have some brief opening words. For years, I wanted to be older, and now I am. Margaret Atwood. Women may be the one group that grows more radical with age. Gloria Steinem. I have a short reading from one of the books I'll be talking about today, In Our Prime by Susan J. Douglas, How Older Women Are Reinventing the Road Ahead. And let me just do this here. How many, let me get everyone so I can see them here. How many of you are in the baby boomer generation? You can raise your real hand, and I think we have a fair number in these congregations. So she says, I'm a baby boomer and thus a woman, as we would say politely, of a certain age. And as I blink my eyes and wonder, as so many of us do these days, how did I get here? I'm feeling once settled tectonic plates rumbling beneath our feet, changing what it means to be an older woman in America. They're especially shifting about what older women want and how we see ourselves. While not yet widely noticed, given everything else on our nation's overcrowded and hyperventilating screens, it is an impending and major upheaval in our cultural terrain. On the one hand, our culture seems intent on trying to rope women of my vintage off into a honey-hued, quiet, quilted preserve where we are as relevant and as stimulating as pet rocks. All too many drug ads on television, for example, suggest that we are supposed to go plant peonies and play peekaboo with our grandchildren. We're also supposed to keep quiet about and ignore the muscular events by the mostly white-haired men our age or older to reverse so many of the gains women of our generation achieved. On the other hand, the ropes are giving way because the numbers are adding up. There are more women over the age of 50 than ever before in our country. And millions of us are not pottering in the garden or inclined to say, okay, whatever, to the trashing of our legacy, the mowing down of women's rights, the marginalizing of our generation, what we have accomplished and who we are. So I see this as a major turnstile moment in our culture and our history. And I want to say to Barb Park and any other gardeners out there, it's not to put down gardening. So you may remember last spring as the pandemic was ramping up, there were several public statements like the following. Oh, it mostly affects old people. They're going to die soon anyway. Or these are people who are not contributing to society. They're just using resources at a cost to the rest of us. Then there was the lieutenant governor of Texas who famously volunteered that he would be glad to sacrifice himself so that his grandchildren could enjoy the fruits of unfettered capitalism. Now, I took my title from an interview on the PBS NewsHour at the end of 2020 about people over 50 who had lost jobs during the pandemic. And one woman said she was in the invisible stage of life. She was ignored in public and she received no responses to abundant job applications. And this report showed that when older people did get jobs, they were often at a much lower salary than before. I have a couple of caveats about this talk. As with most of my talks, I am not an expert in this field. Probably some of you have backgrounds in health or law or public policy where you have knowledge and experience. You also may have real life experience that you'd like to share. So I hope you'll chime in during our discussion. It happened that in 2020, there were two new books that came out. One was In Our Prime. The other one was by Gail Collins, No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. Gail Collins is a New York Times columnist and the author of several books about American women in history. And Susan J. Douglas writes more about cultural issues. One of her, a famous book she wrote is called Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media, about the effect of movies, TV, popular songs, and so on, for those of us who were baby boomers. Now, the fact that I'm focusing more on a women's experience doesn't mean that the issue is irrelevant for men. In the book White Fragility, which we just read in Prairie, the author Robin DiAngelo says, all progress we have made in civil rights has been accomplished through identity politics, women's suffrage, the Americans with Disability Act, Title IX, recognition of same-sex marriage. The current buzzword of intersectionality applies. If you are older and you are also a woman, if you are also Black, gay, transgender, or living with any kind of disability, effects of discrimination are magnified. Pointing out discriminatory structures helps all of us live in a fairer society. What is ageism? A short definition is that it's discrimination based on age. It involves holding negative stereotypes about people of whatever age. It could be used to discriminate against any group, for example, teenagers, but it's most recognized in relation to older people. Researcher Susan Fiske suggested that several stereotypes about older people contribute to ageism. The first is succession. Older people have had their turn and should get out of the way or the workplace to make room for a younger cohort. The second is consumption. Older people need more resources, which would be better spent on people who will be contributing to society longer. And the third is identity. Younger people and many older people have absorbed stereotypes from the media, their families, and our culture in general about the weaknesses of older people and what is typical behavior. But many things that people know about older citizens are just untrue. For instance, an employer may assume that an older worker will be absent more for health reasons. In reality, absenteeism is generally higher for younger workers. Or they think older workers will have trouble reporting to a younger boss or have trouble learning new technology. None of these things are helped by the myriad of jokes about aging that involve forgetfulness, incompetence, and incontinence. Birthday cards point out that from 30 on, you are over the hill. So for those of you younger people who are listening, who may think this doesn't apply to you, a Washington Post article on December 29th, 2020 points out that the first millennials turn 40 this year, which is old enough to sue for age discrimination. In a recent analysis published in the Journal of Political Economy, Tulane University economist Patrick Button reported on his research. They sent to U.S. employers 40,000 resumes, and they had different ages and genders. By age 50, women were getting significantly fewer responses than their younger peers. For men, the age penalty didn't kick in till later, but by age 65, there was a sharp drop for both genders. Texas economist Joanna Leahy found a similar trend. In her study, ratings of women's resumes dropped off sharply at age 36 or even earlier. One theory is that women in their 30s and 40s are assumed to have children at home, which will make it harder for them to work long hours or have changing schedules. Now, that was about hiring. In regard to firing, whenever there's a recession, it has been documented to hit older employees more. They're generally more expensive to retain. Their expertise is often disregarded in favor of a younger person who will be cheaper and theoretically more trainable. I've worked in several big corporations and I've seen older employees pushed out by managers who changed the job responsibilities, the hours, or the requirements, and then fired the employees for not adapting quickly enough, or they just made them miserable enough to quit. Age discrimination can be difficult to prove in both hiring and firing, especially since companies have a phalanx of lawyers and HR reps to protect them. It's especially tricky for older women. As the law stands now, according to Susan J. Douglas, Women have to sue for either age or gender discrimination. It's not possible to sue for both. So those are just the issues with the workplace. In the area of health, older patients' concerns of both genders are often dismissed as just the result of age. They're prescribed a constellation of drugs that can themselves cause adverse effects or interreactions. And there are the daily indignities of being considered not quite a whole person. Today, I'll give you a very brief overview of the history of women in America and look at where we are now and what we need to do for the future. Some of you may remember that in a previous talk, I remarked that women in colonial America actually had more opportunities than you might think. There were still more men than women in society, and men were often away fighting, sailing, working in remote areas. So women had the chance to run some businesses. Famously, Abigail Adams ran the family farm for years, and Ben Franklin's sister managed the post office. Widows were possibly the best off, as throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, they were usually able to own property and control their own money in a way that married women could not. But after the Revolution and going into the Victorian era, opportunities for women and the value assigned to them declined, especially older women. The 1842 report of the Indigent Widows and Single Women's Society concluded, "With the aged, we have few sympathies. They belong to a generation that has passed away. They can promise us neither reciprocation nor reward. Our reverence for them is rarely an active principle. That is, everyone talks about revering the old, but it is not acted upon." In the suffragist era, middle age was a time of freedom to pursue political ends. For instance, Elizabeth Cady Stanton actively joined the movement when her seven children were older. In 1895, Frances Willard, a suffragist and president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, published the book A Wheel Within a Wheel, describing, as she said, how at the ripe age of 59, she learned to ride this newfangled thing called a bicycle. Most of the suffragists we hear about were white middle-class women, but many Black women had formed clubs for education and social action. One of Harriet Tubman's last acts was to open a residence for the Black elderly in her hometown. In the early 20th century, prominent women over 40 included Mary Harris, who you will know under the name of Mother Jones. She championed the unions. Then there was Ida Tarbell, whose writings exposed the monopoly of Standard Oil, other muckraking issues. And there were entertainers such as Lillian Russell, Ma Rainey, currently the subject of a Netflix movie, and later Mae West. On the other hand, the 1920s was the era of youth and flappers, hedonism. It was at this time that hair dyeing became somewhat mainstream, even though the products were questionable, probably dangerous. As the Depression set in, unsurprisingly, those first affected were women, and especially older women. The consensus was that women were taking a job away from a man who would be supporting a family. One magazine article was entitled, "You Can Have My Job, A Feminist Discovers Her Home." Of course, a woman might also be the sole support of her family if her husband were dead, disabled, or roaming the country looking for work, or had just deserted. The president who was to attack the Depression head-on, Franklin D. Roosevelt, brought with him his 48-year-old First Lady, Eleanor. Eleanor Roosevelt set a new standard for First Lady's involvement in social action, visiting slums, farms, and prisons, being very engaged. Probably the reform that most impacted older women under Roosevelt was the establishment of Social Security. But it had built-in biases. So Gail Collins writes about how Social Security was set up at that time. The world into which Social Security was born presumed men were the family breadwinners. If the wife worked, chances were it wouldn't be reflected in their check. And if a non-working wife lost her husband before age 60, she got nothing. Ditto for many who were divorced. The country would spend the next decades wrestling with the program's deficits. And it's, so some of these things have been adjusted over time. Of course, one of the biggest issues in the original Social Security bill was everyone it left out, including domestics and agricultural workers. And of course, these were fields largely occupied by minorities, and domestics were overwhelmingly female. I'm sure you're all aware of the surge of women into the workplace during World War II, represented by Rosie the Riveter, and the opposing cultural pressure for women to go back home once the men returned. Marriage and children were the goal. In the post-war film, It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey gets to see the dystopia his town would have become without him. The crowning horror, beautiful Donna Reed is a dowdy librarian wearing glasses, an old maid. In order for the post-war family to have its suburban lifestyle, old-fashioned multi-generational living had to be transformed. Grandma had to go somewhere else. The 60-ish maybe Eisenhower, with her bangs and fussy pink ball dresses, was replaced by the young, sleek, and trendy Jackie Kennedy. Even in the civil rights movement, while women did a huge amount of work organizing and building community, leaders were almost exclusively male and youthful. Andrew Young, who would later become mayor of Atlanta, remembered feeling at the time that people like Ella Baker were too much like my mother. Strong women were the backbone of the movement, but to young Black men seeking their own freedom, dignity, and leadership perspective, they were quite a challenge. Ella Baker was one of the first organizers of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She was an acting director, but when the position was made permanent, the job went to a younger man. After all, who was I? She asked bitterly. I was female. I was old. In politics, a few mature women stood out in the 20th century. Jeanette Rankin was elected U.S. Representative from Montana even before the national franchise for women was won. And then she was reelected in 1940 at the age of 60. She voted against entry into both World War I and World War II based on her beliefs. Margaret Chase Smith was a conservative and anti-communist, but she was appalled by her senatorial colleague, Joseph McCarthy, and spoke out about him before others did. In 1964, she brushed off suggestions that she could be a running mate to Barry Goldwater and launched her own presidential campaign. Now, we may not agree with all her politics, but you might be interested in this quote. No Stopping Us Now, the media seemed incapable of discussing Smith's campaign without describing her as silver-haired. She complained that almost every news story starts off with the 66-year-old senator. She said, I haven't seen the age played up in the case of men candidates. The Los Angeles Times reported on that interview with a story that was headlined, 66-year-old Senator Smith hits age talk. In reading these books, I sometimes was struck by how eras I think of as modern, for instance, the 1970s, were actually stuck in a previous era. In 1972, Geritol had a famous commercial. A husband brags about how great his wife is. She does the cooking, cleaning, takes care of the children, keeps herself fit, and takes Geritol. The husband sitting in an easy chair ends by saying, "My wife, I think I'll keep her." Joni Caucus, a middle-aged housewife in the comic strip Doonesbury, had a retort. She ends up leaving home, moving to the commune with the students, and she tells them, "My husband leaned back in his chair and said with a big stupid grin, 'My wife, I think I'll keep her. I broke his nose.'" This character, Joni, went on in the strip to apply to law school at a time when most universities rejected a middle-aged woman. And this character in the comic strip eventually became an aide to an older female representative who had a lot of similarities with the real-life representative Millicent Fenwick of New Jersey. So in real life, Fenwick won a primary against an up-and-coming young man. The party had expected her to step gracefully aside for the new generation, but she said, "There was something about that expectation that got under my skin." She became a freshman senator at the age of 64. Of course, that's not that remarkable for a man. It was 65-year-old Maggie Kuhn who founded the Gray Panthers in 1970. Its resonance with the concurrently famous Black Panthers indicated they were not a polite society of rocking chair grandparents. They worked on many issues, including opposing compulsory retirement ages and adding kneeling entrances to New York City buses, that is, the platforms that can go up and down to make it easier access. They worked on a variety of issues. One idea was to have older people, or older and younger people, live in communal setups. Maggie Kuhn herself, at 75, lived with a family of choice that included seven younger men and women. One of the younger residents was concerned about having male friends over. When she mentioned it to Maggie, the response was, "It's all right with me. Do you mind if I have them over too?" In 1986, Newsweek ran a famous cover story announcing that an educated white 40-year-old woman was more likely to be killed by a terrorist than to marry. Odds were even worse if you were Black. Women could not have it all. Now, Collins says the story was deeply inaccurate. Newsweek eventually retracted it, although it took 20 years to do so. Meanwhile, it haunted an entire generation. Through the years, focus groups found that women like Bella Abzug, Geraldine Ferraro, and Hillary Clinton reminded men of their mothers, mothers-in-law, and ex-wives, and not in a good way. But in the last few years, it sometimes seemed that we were being saved by grandmothers, Nancy Pelosi, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and almost Hillary Clinton. The incoming Biden administration, knowing there's no time for on-the-job training, features many experienced people of all genders over 50 years old. My reading from Susan J. Douglas that I started with ended with a reminder of how active women 50 and over are in society. Yet if you went by popular culture and advertisements, you would think this group didn't exist. We're too often represented by a helpless woman moaning, "I'm fallen and I can't get up." Medical advertisements directed at older people tend to show happy people being active. But the men are driving tractors, playing sports, and working on construction, while the women are shopping, doing a little light gardening, or playing with their grandchildren. In popular culture, Helen Mirren, one of the few to play active parts throughout her life, said, "It's outrageous. We all sat there watching as James Bond got more geriatric and his girlfriends got younger and younger." When middle-aged and older women are targeted in ads, it's often for anti-aging products, face creams, hair color, diet aids. Aging is presented as an unfortunate medical or even moral lapse that should be fought against with all available weapons. Despite being a longtime active feminist, Susan J. Douglas puts some of the blame for the invisibility of older women on the feminist movement. She says, "Issues affecting older women, how they're treated at work, their economic prospects, how government policies hurt or help them, whether doctors take them seriously, the negative attitudes and discrimination they may face, how all of this is shaped by race and class, and how the media promote, undermine, or simply ignore their needs and rights, have not been central to the feminist agenda." And the press plays up any catfight that seems to occur. For instance, there was some discussion between Gloria Steinem and some younger women activists in 2016, or between Nancy Pelosi and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that the press wants to gin up some kind of fight. A substantial part of Douglas's book is politically radical. She states, "The avid belief in the free market is not only sexist, it is also ageist and racist, and has women of a certain age directly in its crosshairs. While gutting Medicare or Social Security will affect everyone, women live longer than men and typically have less saved up in Social Security because of lifelong lower salaries, work interruptions to care for children or others, minimal or no savings because they did not work outside the home, or like domestic workers, they were paid under the table and have nothing. Medicaid is also crucial to them. African American and Latina women have been especially concentrated in lower paid jobs that typically lack pensions of any sort, and they are much less likely to have any home equity or lifelong investments. Douglas challenges those of us who are well off in retirement to make common cause with those who aren't. Douglas has an extended section on Social Security where she declares that the so-called crisis of bankruptcy of Social Security is no more true than the impossibility of marriage for women over 40 from the Newsweek story. She says that this myth was taken up and broadcast by mainstream media of all types. One of the most discouraging things about it was the way it was used to drive a wedge between older and younger generations. The young were told that nothing will be left for you because baby boomers who are so selfish have used it up. Douglas ends with 7 recommendations for the future. 1, embrace our coming of age. Refuse to be confined by stereotypes and show up, living our real lives. 2, talk back to gendered ageism. Respond to being called dismissively, hun, or, strangely but true, young lady. Talk back to the media. Contact media outlets and sponsors who perpetuate ageist stereotypes. 4, expose the sexist hypocrisies of market fundamentalism. Older women who are financially secure can speak up for those who aren't in political issues that affect the well-being of women. More women could become economists. We could look at a gross national happiness project. 5, contradict mansplaining statistics. Saying we can't afford childcare or preschools for everyone or healthcare for everyone when statistics actually show the worth of these. 6, build bridge feminism. Feminists and other progressive groups of all ages and communities can work together for common goals. 7 is get active, get political, and donate. Many women were launched into the community by the Women's March in 2017 or by Black Lives Matter or other groups. And now that some changes are being made, don't get complacent. And her conclusion, which I'll end with, is it is time individually and collectively to rip off the invisibility cloak. It is time to talk back. It is time to hold hands. Let's do it now. We certainly found that when my husband and I moved to Madison, when he was over 50 and looking for a job, he had been working at the same company for over 20 years. But when he changed his resume to have only the last job title, so it wasn't as obvious how old he was, he started to get more responses. Our closing from Alexandra Robin. The aging aren't only the old, the aging are all of us.